Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. In a bit, a look at that raid by U.S. Special Forces to free non-American hostages in Yemen.
But first, the news that Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had a stent operation after she experienced discomfort during routine exercise. A statement from the court says the 81-year-old justice is recovering comfortably at a Washington, D.C. hospital. But what has NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg heard? Nina is also in D.C. Nina, what have you heard?
Well, she's not only awake and alert, she's demanding work from her staff. She's talking to friends on the phone. She's expected to go home tomorrow and expects to be on the bench on Monday.
Okay. Well, we get an idea of what a vital 81-year-old this is because she was, after all, exercising when this happened. But what happened and what kind of procedure was this?
I gather that she experienced some minor pain and her trainer got hold of her secretary, and they talked her into going into the hospital and getting it checked out. And when they checked it out, they found that one artery was blocked. The rest of the heart is apparently absolutely fine, but this one artery was blocked. So she had this stent procedure. I don't think they even call it an operation. Of course, doctors never call anything an operation. I say that as the wife of a surgeon. But in this procedure, what they did was they thread a balloon up through either your groin or your arm, and I gather they did it through her wrist, up through her arm, and then they blow up the balloon to get out the blockage from your heart. Mm-hmm. They then pull a string on the balloon, essentially, and it then opens up the artery so that it's no longer blocked by the accumulation right. of stuff that's there.
Very common procedure. We also know that Justice Ginsburg is a two-time cancer survivor. In 1999, she was treated for colon cancer. Then in 2009, she had a survey for pancreatic cancer. But are there any other concerns about her health right now? Because as you well know, people are eyeing her seat on that bench warily.
Well, she has been very clear about the fact that she has no intention of going anywhere as long as she can do the work. And anybody who's watched any of the interviews that she's done, and I've done a couple of them, for example, at the 92nd Street Y, I did one this year, you sort of marvel at all the marbles that she has in her head, and you feel kind of stupid compared to her. She speaks very carefully. She doesn't say something she doesn't want to say, but there's never an or an and there's sort of total recall of the kind that's absolutely phenomenal. She is, you know, but when you look at her, she's probably 90-some-odd pounds, and she's a teeny little person. And she looks frail, but she can do lots of push-ups. I mean, she was working out.
With a trainer.
With a trainer.
Nina, you know the debate. I mean, liberals like Erwin Chemerinsky of the University of California Law School are calling on her to resign to ensure that a Democratic president would appoint her successor. How is this going to dovetail into that debate, do you think?
Well, the only person this matters to is her. And what she has said continually, she said it to me, she said it to other reporters, she said it on the record, is who can the president get through the Senate? And this was before they even lost control of the Senate. Who do you think the president can get through the Senate who's better than me? And I think the subtext is, or that I would think is better than me, that I would think will carry the banner for the things that I care about, including very much women's rights and some other issues. Yeah. So I don't see that in the cards anytime soon. And, you know, as you said, she's on the one hand, she's 81. Anything can happen anytime. On the other hand, Justice Kennedy had a stent inserted in 2005. That's whatever it is, number of years ago, and he's fine.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned her age, and that's the other debate. She was appointed by President Clinton in 1993. She served 21 years. There are people who argue there should be an age limit.
Well, there are people who have proposed putting a term limit or an a term limit, a time of that you can't serve more than X number of years. And I, you know, I heard proposals like that from conservatives when liberals dominated the court. I hear them now from liberals when conservatives dominate the court. It would take a constitutional amendment, 2/3 of the House and Senate, plus 3/4 of the states. I think the odds of that ever happening are pretty dim.
Yeah. Nina Totenberg, NPR Legal Affairs correspondent, talking about the news today that Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Justice Ginsburg, had to have a heart stent operation. But as Nina reports, Ginsburg expects to be back on the bench working on Monday. And Nina, you mentioned your 92nd Street Y evening with her. That was the night where she told you that she had notorious RBG t-shirts.
She loves to give them out as gifts. She has tons of them, and she's sort of, it was her clerks called this site to her attention, and she loves it.
Yeah. Well, we will link people to your conversation at herenow.org. Nina, thank you.
Thank you.
Return to Yemen now, where U.S. Special Operations Forces embarked on a daring mission yesterday. It was to free 8 hostages who were being held by an al-Qaeda affiliate group in a remote cave. The pre-dawn raid involved about 24 U.S. commandos and a small number of American-trained Yemeni troops. In the end, they freed 6 Yemeni citizens, a Saudi and an Ethiopian, none of whom were armed. Officials say the reports that one of the hostages was an American were incorrect. The Pentagon will not confirm that U.S. forces were indeed involved in the raid. They say only that the U.S. supports Yemen's efforts to counter terrorism. Eric Schmidt is following this story for the New York Times. Eric, you write that this was a rare and risky mission. How rare was it?
Indeed, this is very unusual for U.S. Special Operations Forces to conduct a mission. This was in an eastern province of Yemen, an al-Qaeda-infested area. But at the request of President Hadi of Yemen, the U.S. Provided this support, as you said, about 24 commandos. And what they did was, under cover of darkness, they flew by using special helicopters to within a few hundred meters of this target, the cave you mentioned, and then hiked in by foot so they could use the element of surprise to take on the al-Qaeda militants who are guarding this cave and the hostages inside. Yemeni officials said yesterday they killed, the team killed about 7 of these Qaeda militants and safely rescued the hostages, who, along with the commandos, were whisked away on the same helicopters to safety.
Who were the hostages? Why did the U.S. go through this mission?
Well, we don't know exactly a lot. One of them we do know from one of my colleagues in Yemen was able to determine was a professor who was apparently kidnapped about a year ago. The militants thought because he had some expertise in chemistry and all, he might be an explosives expert. He also had trained at a police academy. So I think he was captured for what they believe were his technical skills. We don't know much about the other hostages as well. There was a senior Saudi diplomat kidnapped about a year ago in this general vicinity. The Saudi embassy in Washington, when I contacted them yesterday, said they didn't have any details yet on who the Saudi national was who was rescued safely.
So how does this fit into the overall mission against al-Qaeda and al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in Yemen? Because we know there have been numerous U.S. drone strikes there that are targeting militants. How does this particular mission fit into the larger picture?
So this fits into the larger picture because this was a request that came from President Hadi, the president of Yemen, who took over for Ali Abdullah Saleh a couple of years ago.
Somebody who's a U.S. ally, seen as a U.S. ally in a very strategic region.
Exactly. Very staunch ally. But he's come under fire in just the last several weeks. Some Shia rebels have come down from the north. They're called Houthis. They have overrun Sana'a and basically dictated terms on reorganizing the government. So I think in this case, this is a beleaguered ally who still is very important in the counterterrorism fight. The al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen is still deemed to be the most immediate threat to the United States because of its bomb makers. Even with the ISIL threat that we're now seeing, the al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen poses the most direct threat to the United States. So in this case, I think the U.S. was basically helping out an ally in this to try and get some of its citizens back.
Remind us how the al-Qaeda-affiliated group in Yemen is such a threat to the U.S.
Well, they have a particular bomb maker by the name of Asiri. And dating back, you may recall the so-called underpants bomber, the young man who tried to blow himself up on an airliner over to Detroit on Christmas Day of 2009, and 2 subsequent attempts to try and smuggle bombs aboard aircrafts that were American-bound. So this is a very dangerous group that have both showed they have the capacity and the and the willingness to try and attack the United States, not only in the region, but here in the U.S.
Is there a danger, though, if the United States is trying to perhaps bolster the status of this president, whose reputation is flagging somewhat in Yemen, that it'll look like this is a U.S. job instead of a Yemeni job, because it sounds like it was indeed mostly driven by the U.S.?
Well, there are those risks. I think in this case, in fact, when the statement was put out yesterday in Yemen, there was no mention of the fact that the U.S. played any role at all. This was billed as an operation mounted by Yemeni counterterrorism forces, who you indicated are American trained. So the U.S. and the Yemeni forces have been training together for the last several years. They've been trying to stiffen that partnership. But as you mentioned, there are some risks to having the American role in this publicized. But I think the downside, of course, was the fate of the hostages could have become even worse.
The larger picture in this is what, Eric? When the U.S. decides to mount a mission like this that you say is very rare and sounds extremely risky, how is the decision made that it's worth it?
Well, they obviously would go over the intelligence to and determine, you know, where the hostages are being held, what, you know, how many are being guarded, and what access the U.S., you know, commandos, in this case with the Yemeni troops, what they would have, how the difficulty of the operation, the surrounding landscape, and just the risks versus the benefit. It's a risk-benefit analysis that they would carry out. This was a mission that came up rather on short notice, just in the last couple of weeks. They did have to do the planning fairly quickly. And then there was a window that opened about 48 to 72 hours when they believed they had a shot at getting these guys back safely. This, of course, is a template for not only missions in Yemen, but other places where there could be Western hostages, including American hostages. Of course, we've been sorely reminded in recent days of the hostages that still remain in Syria. This is a capability that we could see duplicated there. Of course, there was a failed rescue mission in July trying to recover some of the U.S. Hostages there in Syria. When the commandos got to the site, the prisoners, unfortunately, had been moved. So this is a very tricky, difficult business these guys are in.
All right. Thank you. Talking to us about the U.S.-led raid in Yemen, Eric Schmidt, reporter for The New York Times. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Remember the controversial law enforcement program known as Secure Communities? Undocumented immigrants picked up by local police, usually for minor violations like a broken taillight. Then they were fingerprinted. If those fingerprints matched a federal immigration database, they could be kept in local jails through Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement holds known as detainers and eventually deported. President Obama, as part of his executive actions last week, is doing away with that. Under the new program that will replace Secure Communities, only the more serious criminals will be deported. Secure Communities got its start in and around Houston, Texas, back in 2008. What do the changes mean? Let's check in there. Harris County Sheriff Adrian Garcia joins us. He took office shortly after Secure Communities started there. Welcome, Sheriff.
Thank you for having me.
Part of the change is this change in Secure Communities. Now, what was the effect of the old program on you and on, by the way, your jail system? For instance, you have the third largest jail in the country there in your county.
That's correct. You know, initially when we first took office, Harris County was generating about 1,000 detainers a month to ICE. And over the years, and I was involved in some of the advocacy for clear rules of engagement and addressing much of the outcry from the community, at the same time making sure that we did not lose sight of our core mission, and that is to be a local law enforcement organization that any person from any walk of life could come to us and report a crime and not have to be concerned about their immigration status. I think that advocacy got us to a point where we're at today, where we're generating on average about 200 to 300 detainers a month now. And as I look at the reports, they seem to be somewhat consistent with the mission of what we've been hearing from the administration, that is focusing on the most violent and previously removed individuals as part of their given priorities.
So you said a couple of things here. First of all, you feel you were already streamlining the program, as you say, from like 1,000 detainees, people that immigration officials were asking your local police to hold longer. You feel you've already streamed that from 1,000 back down to about 250. What the president talked about, felons, not families.
That is correct. We didn't sit idly. We wanted to make sure that we were being a voice for the community, listening to their concerns and their frustrations, and then holding ICE accountable, quite honestly.
Well, let's explain why, because you mentioned something else. you said you wanted to make sure that your local police ended up being people the community wanted to turn to. This was a major concern of the Secure Communities program, that it turned police into immigration officials, because another part of the Secure Communities program, that was the database, then 287G was the companion program that deputized local law enforcement to interview these immigrants brought in for minor infractions. And if there was nothing to turn up in the database, they had to keep interviewing them to find something to deport them. And the criticism was this turned your local police into investigators.
That's correct. The community wanted to, was concerned rather, and did want to see local law enforcement becoming quasi-ICE enforcement agents. And we tried hard to make sure that there was a true firewall between those respective roles. And so I've had to do a lot of my own reforming, if you will, at the local level, requiring that ICE be present, let them be engaged by the community, let them hear what the community concerns are, and let local law enforcement continue to provide the public safety that all citizens and residents of our community should expect.
But you said you were worried about it being abused. Did you see it abused? Did you see police, for instance, pulling over people that they just suspected of being undocumented for things like brake lights or, you know, minor infractions just to get them into this program?
No, you know, thankfully we didn't see anything overt, what would be typically referred to as racial profiling. Only a small percentage of my cases were those cases that were what we would consider Class C offenses, being citation or traffic offense related. Very small percentage of them. But you don't want a community having the concern that on one side of town, they're going to be treated differently than they are on the other side of the town, and that one rule is going to apply over here and it won't apply over there. And at the end of the day, as the sheriff of Harris County, I want to go after anybody involved with gangs and trafficking in humans and smuggling drugs. I'm not going to tolerate anyone involved in that kind of business, no matter what their immigration status is.
So under the new program, if people who do show up on the fingerprinted database as having done those things, you will, it sounds like, happily forward them to the feds for deportation.
I will happily turn them over to ICE and let ICE do what they think they need to do and whatever their rules now say that they should do. But we want to make sure that if you've got a hardworking dad that is out there putting roofs on a house, on new homes, that's out there mowing lawns for an affluent community, that's out there washing dishes in one of our finest restaurants, but that their family isn't traumatized just because that person is here trying to do the right things for the right reasons, but it just hasn't been able to get that immigration status that one would want.
And happens to have a taillight out.
And look, when my local business leaders say to me that they support comprehensive immigration reform, when my business leaders tell me that comprehensive immigration reform will strengthen our economy, and when they tell me that comprehensive immigration reform will give young people a pathway to better lives, then I've got to respect that. We've got to move this forward to get it legislated, create a law so that there's no ambiguity on whether it's temporary or whether it's permanent.
And again, that's under the President Obama's executive action. It is temporary, a temporary reprieve from deportation, including this change in the secure communities. But I want to ask you, Sheriff, we understand you're from an immigrant family.
I'm the only American born in my family. My parents came here in 1959. My father was a migrant worker. He was a guest worker in the 40s, came to the U.S. to work, helped to build the rail lines. He waited in line. He got that permission. You know, the story that I'm told when my family crossed the border, that my dad quickly pulled our station wagon over and made everybody kneel on the side of the road, giving thanks to God for being able to come to this country of great opportunity, that we're going to be good citizens, we're going to work hard, we're going to play by the rules, but that we're going to give this country back everything that it could possibly give us. But it's also important that he also gave me a very, very critical pearl of wisdom when I entered my career in law enforcement, and that was, don't ever forget where you come from.
You have a great personal story, but you know there are people, I'm sure you've heard from people saying, you shouldn't be the one in charge of this exactly because you might have a soft spot for immigrants.
Now, look, I'm all about law and order, Robin. Yeah. If you put a gun or a knife to anybody's throat, I'm going to throw your butt in jail. But when someone is here and they have violated a civil law, then I'm going to let the federal law enforcement authorities do what they need to do. But in the meantime, if that person is working hard, they're waiting on tables, they're mowing lawns, and someone robs them of their money, then that person should expect me to go out there and protect them, investigate their case, and put the real predator in jail.
That's Harris County Sheriff Adrian Garcia in Houston. Sheriff Garcia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear from other towns, especially local police who are also looking at changes to the Secure Communities program. Do you feel the same way, that it should be changed and that it harms the community relationship with the police to make them de facto agents?
Watch TV for a nanosecond today and you can't miss the ads telling you Black Friday is on the way. Of course, if you can't wait until Friday, some stores will be open tomorrow on Thanksgiving Day. And Target, The Gap, and others have been offering Black Friday-type discounts for days now. As one top Walmart executive said recently, the new Black Friday should really be called November. Jordan Weissman of Slate joins us now. Jordan, is Black Friday really losing its clout?
I don't think it's losing. I mean, you know, the National Retail Foundation thinks that 140 million shoppers are going to take advantage of Black Friday deals, both in stores and online. So, you know, from Thanksgiving kind of on, I wouldn't say it's totally losing its clout. I think that there was this arms race going on to open earlier and earlier, and to open early and earlier. And stores like Walmart are now realizing that if they just extend the sales throughout the month, it just makes more sense than having a bunch of people line up at a door and kind of create a health hazard for these giant.
But then you lose the sense of competition. I mean, is it more lucrative for retailers when the big bargains are all packed into one day like Friday?
It's actually not clear that it raises overall sales. I think the reason you've seen this competition is because it's sort of a collective action problem. Each retailer is worried about losing their own share of the market, but the market itself isn't necessarily getting any bigger. So, you know, it's almost better for everyone if the sales are just, I think, personally, and it seems like Walmart's realizing it's better for almost everyone if sales are just kind of spread out a bit more rather than these totally crazed moment where everyone lines up at midnight.
Well, let's talk about some of the employees at some of the larger retailers anyway. There are certain states, as you know, Rhode Island among them, Maine and Massachusetts, that have laws that ban some retailers from being open on Thanksgiving. But across the country, we're seeing more and more open on the holiday. Are employees who work on Thanksgiving getting paid more for working?
I mean, Walmart, for instance, says that they get an extra day's pay, but it's kind of that's actually a very complicated calculation that has to do with their pay over the past 12 weeks. They don't have to give people overtime. No, I mean, there are no required paid holidays in the United States. We're the only truly advanced nation that doesn't require any kind of paid holidays. So that's part of the issue here. A lot of people are kind of dragooned into working on this holiday. Kmart was allegedly threatening people, according to Think Progress, of being fired if they didn't come in when they were told on Thanksgiving. So a lot of people don't get to enjoy the holiday and don't want to be working. They don't even necessarily want the paycheck.
Yeah, and there's an Ohio lawmaker who's authored a bill that would require retailers to pay triple the hourly wages to employees working on Thanksgiving, and it also would ban merchants from doing what you mentioned, from retaliating against workers who want to take the holiday off. If, for instance, employees were to get double, triple their normal wage for working on holiday, what would be the impact of that?
I think it's hard to say. I imagine it would... many stores would reconsider opening. It's expensive to open a store, period. It's if you had to pay everyone triple, especially you probably have to staff up a little bit more when you have these kind of frenzied holiday sales going on, because, again, you need people to watch the madness and make sure no one gets hurt. So it would become exceedingly expensive, and it might stop a lot of stores from doing these kinds of sales.
Okay. Jordan Weissman of Slate, thanks for speaking with us about the state of Black Friday. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving is upon us, so now a story of gratitude. On a recent Sunday, congregants at Chicago's LaSalle Street Church were expecting to, as usual, bank a little spiritual wealth and maybe leave a little thanks in the collection cup. So imagine their shock when the pastor told all 320 worshipers that they were getting checks for $500 to use however they choose. Pastor Laura Truax joins us from Chicago. And Pastor Truax, let's back up. This money came to your small non-denominational church through a real estate deal?
I know, if you can believe it. It was actually a real estate sale that had an investment of $1,000 in the mid-70s. We had built a housing complex that was a mixed income, mixed race complex back in the day, and the major investor wanted to sell. So that's how it came about.
Yeah, well, that $1,000, it's just like the loaves of bread, because that $1,000 turned into what, $1.6 million?
I know. Crazy, isn't it?
So you get $1.6 million from that sale, and then you decided to take $160,000 and distribute it. What was your thinking?
Well, $1.6 million is a huge number for us. We're a church that's, you know, always on the edge financially. And I was a little concerned that that much money can really change a community and an institution and change people, you know. Mm-hmm. So from the get-go, it felt important for us to say clearly and firmly that we are free with this money. This money is not going to be a millstone. It's going to be an opportunity to do God's work in the big picture of the world. So that first 10%, $160,000, that's a typical thing to tithe on money. And the untypical thing was to tithe it to the people and tell them that they are the tithe and that it is up to them to use their portion of the tithe in the world in the way that they feel directed.
Well, it's so interesting because some churches ask their members to tithe to the church a certain percentage of their income. You're going the other way, tithing it back to them. You were delivering a sermon on the parables of talent. Remind us what that is.
Yeah, it's a wonderful story that Jesus tells about three servants who are given resources and they're told to invest them. And then the master goes away and he comes back sometime later and asks, what did you do with it? And one guy says, I've doubled it. The second person says, I've doubled it. And the third guy says, I was scared and I put your money in the ground, in a hole in the ground. So I challenged us. We've all been gifted with some amazing resources. This $500 just kind of is concrete and makes it real. But let's go out there and let's just do the business of God in the world.
Double it. So you use the parable to then say to them, and I am giving you $500 checks. What? How did they react?
I'll tell you, they sat there in silence. In fact, I got a little nervous. I was already nervous, and I was kind of sweating and thinking I'm going to be this kind of nutty person in their eyes. And when I said, it's up to you guys, $500, a check is already written out to you. Just go over and pick it up from the table here. And they all just sat there in silence. Mm-hmm. So I paused, and then I just said it again. And after a few minutes, people started to whisper. Some people started to cry. And it became quite a profound moment of what it means to have somebody say and to demonstrate, you know what? I believe in you. God believes in you. Go out there and do something cool with this money.
And what are they doing? What are some of the things you've heard?
Oh, it's amazing. They've given to clinics, they've given to education facilities, they've given to literacy programs, they've given to after-school programs, they've given to missionaries. One man gave to a woman who came about through a friend of a friend from the Ivory Coast, and she needed a prosthetic leg, and so he came alongside her for that. Other people are doing things close to home. A football coach on the South Side is starting a program, an after-school program.
Some people are using that $500 to do things they couldn't have done for themselves, you know, pay rent, pay mortgages.
Certainly.
Yeah.
Certainly.
Well, and now you have over a million left after doing that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You could just build a wing, I bet you need kitchen facilities. I bet, you know, if you know, like any church I've known, you know, you're operating in debt. But instead, you've challenged your parishioners to come up with ideas, and some of them want to, you know, support Ebola clinics.
That's right.
But why not, though? Isn't that part of the parable? If you use the money yourselves to better your church, won't you then, down the road, be better able to do things like work in Sierra Leone? Why not spend it on yourself?
It's not that it's not okay if the church decided to do something like that. I just feel like that idea that we're to build a new wing or to invest in ourselves, that's often our default mechanism, and that doesn't feel at all to me what this gift is all about. We are living at a time when we can really do something about the needs of the world, and it feels as if that should be our default mechanism, to step out in faith and to do something risky and to do something bold and to do something in the lives of other people. I want that to be our default. It's really been, for me, very humbling to hear from people all across the country who are imitating this. A high school on the south side of Chicago that gave all their graduating seniors $50 each and said, go do something with it. Go do something good with it. Isn't that awesome? I mean, how cool is that?
Look what you started.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think God started it first. It could be that at the end of the day, we need to pay off a mortgage or plug our budget hole or whatever, but I sure hope not. I think faith is bigger and grander than that.
Well, given one of the suggestions I'm reading about, we could soon be hearing about the LaSalle Street Church Credit Union.
Oh, yes, exactly. Isn't that an exciting idea? That's right.
Yeah. Laura Truax is pastor of the LaSalle Street Church in Chicago. They invested in a development in the 1970s, $1,000. It was just sold. They've gotten $1.6 million back and given a lot of it to the congregation. Pastor Truax, best of luck to you in what you do with the rest. Oh, and happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
Oh, thank you. And to you as well.
In this note, today the EPA announced a proposal that will require states to eventually clean the air a bit by lowering the level of ground-level ozone pollution, the smog-forming pollution linked to asthma and other problems, to 65 to 70 parts per billion. The current standard of ozone considered healthy to breathe, set in the Bush administration, is 75 parts per billion. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy said the new lower targets are based on thorough and alarming scientific studies.
The result of being exposed to too much ozone can be disruptive, expensive, frightening, and tragic. It can cause us to miss work or school, use medicine more often, send us to the hospital, or lead to premature death.
The American Petroleum Institute and the National Association of Manufacturers call it the most expensive regulation ever imposed, and Republicans are vowing to fight it. But if adopted, states would have 20 years to meet the new limits.
It's that time of year again, the time for new words to emerge, or at least for dictionaries to catch up with the words we've already been using. The Oxford University Press and Dictionary.com just came out with their Words of the Year. Dictionary.com chose exposure, that's with Ebola and credit card hacking in mind. Oxford University Press picked vape, to inhale and exhale the vapor of an e-cigarette. The American Heritage Dictionaries have not chosen a Word of the Year. Why not?
Because the media coverage for Words of the Year is oversaturated.
So says Steve Kleinedler, who's the executive editor of American Heritage Dictionaries. Welcome to our studio, Steve.
Thank you for having me in, Lisa. I appreciate it.
So it sounds like there's a lot of competition, and you have your eye on what the others are doing, the opposition, I suppose you could say, are doing. But you did add this year more than 500 new words to the fifth edition of the Dictionary of the English Language. Of the 500, Steve, which are you most proud of?
Some of the words that we like to talk about are food words, things like banh mi, halloumi, mochi. These are words that started out in various foreign languages, and as American palates widen, become more familiar to Americans. And also interesting words that play a prominent role in today's society, such as dash cam, which is used by insurance companies and people to document crashes that they may have.
So that's a video camera mounted to the inside of a windshield.
Correct.
Pointing out, okay, we've all seen the results of those, or from the other side. Going back to what you said about food, banh mi, B-A-N-H, separate word, M-I, sandwich of Vietnamese origin, and halloumi. I mean, these things have been around for a long time.
Right.
They haven't necessarily been on, you know, at the corner store for a long time.
Exactly. And you know, with banh mi, for example, there's been a slow move into English. And as the concept of banh mi as a sandwich moves beyond just Vietnamese restaurants, and you start seeing it in global American restaurants or other cuisines that aren't normally associated with a Vietnamese restaurant. That's another indication that the word itself has moved from strictly being a Vietnamese word and is entering the English lexicon.
Oh, so something like, say, the Korean entree bibimbap,
yes.
Which is like a hot pot rice dish with vegetables and meat, perhaps. Something like that you'd only see or mostly see in Korean or fusion restaurants, so that's not going to make your list.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because that is a word that we are currently working on and researching for next year.
And how do you do that research? I mean, what are you looking at?
Well, our food editor looks at a variety of not only menus, but checks food sources, looks at recipes that are published in newspapers, blogs, and seeing how wide the term is used. Is it restricted to just these regional cuisines, or does it have a more national flavor to
That's
it.
A big job, though.
It is.
I mean, I just happen to pick bibimbap, but you could do that with a lot of foods.
There is. And it is not coincidental. A large portion of the new material is food related, and the other source being medical terminology. One reason we don't focus on words of the year is because our focus during the year is more towards these meat and potato words that are important, have already been a part of the language. A good example being psychiatry terms with the new issue of the updated edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And as a result of that, that requires a thorough revision or at least a review of all the psychiatric terms that we use, similar to how in 2006 we had to demote Pluto from a planet to a dwarf planet. There's all this existing terminology, especially in the sciences, that constantly change. And that's a really important part of updating a dictionary yearly.
In the general interest category, clickbait, which is, as you define it, provocative or sensationalistic headline text that entices people to click on a link to an article with advertising in mind. The more it clicks, the more money that comes in from advertising. Pregame. That one surprised me that pregame just came up this year.
Specifically, what we added was the partying aspect. Pregame as something that would happen before a game would be understood from its component parts. Pre is a productive prefix that you can add to many words. So pre-game as an adjective would mean something happening before the game. What we've called out is the noun use referring to the party itself that occurs before an athletic competition, similar to tailgating.
Cosplay. Sci-fi convention fans, I think, know this one well. The
exactly.
act of dressing up in a costume to portray a fictional character. When did that go beyond the confines of sci-fi conventions?
I think it had a very robust presence among bloggers and therefore seeped over into traditional media as well. You see it in reference not only to conventions, but the entire industry that springs up around conventions, and it's become a thing that's discussed beyond those borders, so that people who don't engage in cosplay are more likely to be at least aware of it because of all the coverage that it receives.
When you say it moves beyond certain fields into others and broadens in its usage, how do you know that?
By looking at citational evidence, for example, with this, how often is it used in media, both national and regional, as opposed to specific blogs for people who are interested in cosplay? It's similar, analogous to banh mi. Is it being used strictly in Vietnamese restaurants, or is it getting wider play?
Now, Stephen, do you eschew, which I assume is in your dictionary, the word vape, which is what the Oxford University Press chose this year as their word of the year?
It's a perfectly legitimate word, and it has been on our radar for about a year, and we have in the past month begun working on this. But when you add vape, you have to look at many more things. It's caused us to look at the word smoke, at the word vaporize, things like vaporize pens. It's allowed us to revise the definition or working on the revisions to hookah. We had to look at the word atomize. So when you can't just willy-nilly add a word, you have to look at the broader scope.
Is willy-nilly
so,
in there?
Yes.
Good.
As you add these words, you have to look at all of the, it's not just an issue of throwing it in and saying, hey, it's there. You have to look at the domino effect that falls. And one reason it isn't in yet, it's in the process of being put in, but there was so much work that was necessary on so many other words that we need to work on this whole semantic group as a whole.
And you not only added, well, through your panel, new words, but also new usage of words to the dictionary, and in some cases, pronunciations. One issue that you addressed this year was how to use the word and pronounce the word harass or Harris.
Right. Our usage panel advises us for the most part on usage issues. They're a group of about 170 linguists and authors and poets, and we send them a ballot once a year and get their input. Harass, as you mentioned, is interesting in that in 1987, the panel was split as to whether it was pronounced Harris or harass. And then in 2001, 70% favored harass. And just last year, 90% of the panel, that was their preferred form. So in 25 years, among the makeup of the panel that time, it's gone from a 50-50 split to a 90-10 split. Casually, anecdotally, from listening to the news, it seems to me as well that newscasters are saying harass more than Harris.
Does this drive you crazy or do you find it liberating?
Oh, it doesn't drive me crazy at all. Part of our job is to describe how language is being used rather than dictate how it's used. And the great thing about these usage notes is for people who like, irregardless, not a word, we can say, oh, X percent of the panel agrees with you. And it's interesting to see how some things change over time and how others don't.
So you're saying a dictionary is not supposed to dictate?
A good dictionary will tell you how language is used, and it will also tell you, be careful, because if you use this usage this way, many people might accuse you or look at you funny for using a word wrong.
We've been talking about the new words that have been added to the fifth edition of the American Heritage Dictionary with Steve Kleinedler. He's the executive editor of the American Heritage Dictionaries. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on, Lisa.